Okay, let's talk about a few of the minor couples. Starting in, I'm sorry, I'm going a little late. I just got word of a funeral that I had to do. Okay. A few of the minor couples in Yehoshua and Shoftim. We start with the most unlikely couple, which is Yehoshua and Rachav. Right? Of all things, Chazal tell us that Yehoshua married Rachav. And who is Rachav? Rachav, according to the Gemara Megillah, is one of the three most beautiful women who have ever lived. Right? So, won't tell you any more about Gemara right now, but that is not that. So, she's the one who helped Bnei Yisrael in the conquest of their first city of Yericho. Right? She's in the Haftorah of Parshas Shlach, where it's so ironic. In the Torah portion, the people who went in to scout the land of Israel were never in danger, but they projected danger. Right? These two were in danger from the very minute they left, but they projected such confidence. So that the Torah contrasts the Torah portion, right? But while, if I asked you what the name of these 12 men who went into Israel, what do we call them? The 12? Meraglim. Right. Meraglim. We always refer to them as the Meraglim. The Gemara does. The problem is that the text never refers to them as Meraglim.
Yeah, right.
The verb is never used. The word does not appear in Parsha Shlach at all. Right? And the verb l'ragel doesn't appear in Parshat Shlach.
It's latur.
Latur et ha'aretz. The closest you get to that, by the way, it's perfectly fair to use this, is that in Devarim, one of the times in Sefer Devarim, when it reviews their mission, it says, v'yachpiru ha'aretz. Lachpor ha'aretz. Chafar is to dig. So they dug into the land. Okay, I can still make my thesis of this, is that it's a mistake to refer to the mission in Parshat Shlach as a spy mission. That mission was a scouting mission. It's called a scout. So Latur Taurus is to scout. Now, according to the Gemara in Maseches Megillah, when they went on that mission, first, remember, these two missions are 40 years apart. Following? Mm-hmm. When they went on this mission the first time, they met up with Rachav on the first time, too. Right? Now, here is the rub. She is not of the most wonderful professions in the Bible, you know. Right? She has she works at the oldest profession. And some reason why the Chazal insists that Yehoshua married her, I mean, is that the kind of woman that Yehoshua was looking for? All right, there is a prophet in the Tanakh who's actually by God, by command, told to marry a zona. Mm-hmm. Right? Hoshea, the first of the Treasar. We'll get to him shortly. But why do Chazal feel so comfortable with Yehoshua marrying a Zona? Right?
But also somebody out of the tribes.
And not to mention out of the tribes, not someone born Jewish, but also a Canaanite.
They have
many descendants that the rabbis count in amongst the prophets. So, the Gemara in Megillah says they had seven, and another source of this Gemara says eight descendants who were all prophets, amongst them Yirmiyahu. Okay, but be that as it may, the Gemara has a problem. She's marrying a woman of ill repute, someone not born of the nation, but worse, a Canaanite.
Someone who's a harlot, right?
A Canaanite, and the Torah already says, Lo sechaye kol neshama. Mm-hmm. Right, so what's he doing marrying a Canaanite? He's supposed to be rid of Canaanites. So Tosfos actually asks this question in Daf Yudalev in Maseches Megillah and also in Maseches Sota. And this is a question that should bother anyone who reads Sefer Yehoshua. Mm-hmm. What we came to the Yarden? What we were offering these Canaanites? What were we telling them? Right. So this is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Shviyos that says that Yeshua sent three letters to everyone in Canaan. One letter said, we'd like to live in peace with you, right? And you have two options of living in peace with us. One, keep seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, right? Keep the seven Noachide principles that have nothing to do with any ritual of Judaism. You don't have to become like us, and you don't have to become an Israelite at all. just keep the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach that govern all mankind, and you will live side by side with us. We'll come to terms. If you keep 613 mitzvot and you want to follow our Torah, then we are brothers and sisters. We'll run this country together. So you have two options as far as living in peace with us. Seven mitzvot, 613 mitzvot. Option number two. If that doesn't suit you, you could leave. Right? But this is the land God promised our forefathers. In fact, we were here first. When Avraham got there, it said, V'haKna'ani oz ba'aretz. The Kna'anim were by then in the land, says Rashi. That's Rashi's interpretation. Implying that they were not always there. You get it? The Canaanites were not always there. Rashi writes on that pasuk, Hayakovish et ha'aretz mizaro shel shem. Chum was down in the south, Yefet went to the north, Shem was in the Middle East. What's Canaan doing so far up? They took the land from us first. Remember, Rashi says this a few times in this parish to Sefer Bereishis. Rashi would have been an ardent Zionist. His first parish to the Torah was written to justify the place of the Israelite in the land of Israel. Because they say, wherever you go there, what are they going to say? Remember the two words? Listim atem, you stole our land. Yeah. Right? So Rashi says that they will tell them, Bereshit bara Elokim. Now that's not good. That might satisfy us and make us feel justified, but it's not going to satisfy them. What we can tell them is, hey, we were here first. You took it from us first. Now that we're taking it back, now you're calling in now you're making a UN resolution? Right? Okay,
Are the Canaanites among the seven? List them. Emori, Perizi, Hivi, Rusi.
Yeah, Canaan, Chiti, Emori. Yeah, one of the seven nations. Yeah. And sometimes Emori or Canaani is like an overall name for all of them. Sometimes. Okay, so fine. So Rachav obviously took option number one, Mistama 1B, not even 1A, 1B. She wanted to join with her family, and Chazal speak very kindly of what happened. They married and produced. You should see the list of Nevi'im that stem from Yehoshua and Rachab, according to the Gemara. Ayin Sham Daf Yudal in Maseches Megillah. So she changed around her destiny. The problem with this interpretation is that later on in Sefer Yehoshua, try to think, remember if you can remember which nation this was. There was a people that felt they had to deceive Yehoshua into making a peace pact.
Givonim.
Givonim. So the question according to this Gemara is, why did they have to trick Yehoshua into making peace when that was on the table for them at the outset? Why would they go through all this trouble? Remember, they made it look like they were coming from very far, and their shoes were worn out, and their meat was all, the cheese and their food was all all spoiled, and the wine had a film on top, and then their bread was filled with spots. It says, so why did they make it look like they came from so far? Right, they could just make peace. You know the answer?
Either because they feared they're gonna get killed, or they feared they would never be allowed to join.
No, but if Yehoshua sent them this letter that said, join us, so join us.
Yeah, but maybe he didn't believe.
Okay, well, Tosfos says that letter was sent immediately, as before they crossed the Yarden. Once we cross the Yarden, that's too late. I need to hear from you now. Yehoshua sent this letter some time before they crossed the Yarden. So I need to hear from you now. You don't have time to think this over. I need to hear from you in the next month or so. But the story with the Givonim was some years after that. Mm-hmm. Right? So at that point, you're right. It's too late. Yehoshua sent the word out. If you want to make peace with us now, the only way to do it is to trick us, which is what they did.
You don't mean literally a letter, because how do you know they can read? How do you know they
A message. A message.
Okay. Yeah, but I'm sure they were able to write another line.
The Gemara calls it Pruz de Ka'os. The Yerushalmi. Pruz de Ka'os. So it means like messages.
You have the letters of Tel El Amarna, which is 200 years before you.
Okay, alright, so Yehoshua marries Rachav, and it's just very, very interesting that Chazal would have the leader of Israel married to a local zona. So So the fact is, though, that if you look at Rashi here in Yoshua, he says she wasn't a Zona at all. What? Why are you taking away from the Pshat of the Pasuk? You ever hear Rashi quotes the Targum? Targum Yonah's son translates Zona
innkeeper.
Is an innkeeper. Someone who sells mizonos. She's a baker, an innkeeper. Pundak. Right? Which is interesting because Rashi in Yehoshua says that, but the first Rashi in Sefer Yirmiyahu, if you have this Rashi, Rashi says, why is it so appropriate that Yirmiyahu should rebuke the people living at this time? Because Yirmiyahu was descended from Rachav and Yehoshua, right? From bad stock. Yirmiyahu doesn't have good yichus. His yichus is from Azona, right? And Bnei Yisrael have good yichus. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And look, you became bad, and someone with bad yichus became good. God likes a person whose behavior is good, even if the yichus is bad. He doesn't like your... You get it? Yirmiyahu has bad pedigree. Why, says Rashi? Because he comes from Azona. So you see, what is Rashi doing? And Yehoshua, he says that... Sefer Yehoshua, he says that Yehoshua married an innkeeper. And in Yirmiyahu, where it suits him, he says that... you should know that Rashi does this sometimes. In beginning of Parshas Chayisara, in Parshas Toldos, Rashi says that Rivka was three when she married Yitzchak. In Parshas Chayisara, Rashi says that she was more like 17, 20 when she married. By implication, I'll tell you that. So, okay. We're gonna have to deal with that problem some other time. But Chazal say that the text has her as a zona, and the reason why they went to a zona is because she's likely to know information. Right? Remember whenever the rabbis had to in the Gemara, they would go to, this is the Lashon, they would go to Matronisa Shekol Gedole Romi in Etzlaho. Right? So you know, they get the congressman's secrets, you know. So there are the senators, but okay. So she's likely to have the information, and people are going to come to her for information. And she, of course, we know the story. She set them in the wrong direction, and they went running in the wrong, and by that time, the people she was hiding, the two men she was hiding, were able to get. Okay. All right, so
she was a high class.
Maybe, yeah.
Meaning that she had.
Talmud is filled with stories like this. Rabbi Akiva somehow appealed to a Roman matron, and really, and she was so enamored by his goodness and his, what can I say? There are stories like this all over the Talmud and really all over the Bible. As far as Hoshea Hanavi is concerned. There, it is what it is. The whole point is that he's supposed to marry a Zona. Right? The entire Bible even mentions her name. Now, in this particular case, Ibn Ezra says, Cholila v'cholila, that Hoshea actually married a Zona. Tell me, what do you feel here? I mean, the Bible is the Bible. Why are you saying that he married her in a vision? He says, marry a Zona. What's the point of marrying a Zona? It's obvious. Is that Hoshea is a metaphor for God, right? The zone is a metaphor for Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael has played the harlot with God. But still, Hoshea is so much enamored by her and so much in love with her that he finds it's impossible for him to cast her aside. And God feels the same about us. He's stuck with us. So the question is, why is Hoshea, of all prophets, given such a bizarre command? Right? He's not the only prophet who likens the relationship between God and his people as a marriage. Everyone does it.
Does it have to do with
the names? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Hoshea, and Yehoshua's name is also Hoshea. Right? It started off as Hoshea.
Because he cast aspersions. Didn't he cast aspersions?
So they both married Zonas. I never saw that connection.
What was the second Zona, Rabbi?
Her name was Gomer Bastivlayim. But here is the point. Is that the Gemara in Pesachim asks this question, why was Hoshea given such a bizarre command? And the Gemara says, because, and this is based on a Pasuk in the book, there's a Pasuk in the book that the Gemara darshans Moshe was complaining about B'nai Yisrael and how evil they had become.
He was casting aspersions on them.
And saying to God, Hachlifein be'uma acheres, famous line. Hachlifein be'uma acheres. God, these people don't deserve you. If your name is to be exalted, let it be exalted with another people, because they're just not doing it. So God says, what? I may suffer them, and I may, but I will never lose them. I will never destroy them. In fact, Hoshea, let me see how easy it is for you to fall in love with someone who's rebellious. You become so enamored and infatuated. Let's see how easy it is for you to do to her what you're asking me to do to B'nai Israel. So I ask you. Does he actually have to marry this woman and have children with her? He has three children with her. And in the end of the day, God says, you know what, Hoshea? I can tell because I know all things. But I know that you don't even know if these are your children. Right? It's interesting is that in the Medrash, wouldn't it be nice if Hashem tells Hoshea, Hoshea, they are, okay? Sleep easy. God doesn't tell him. Just like he doesn't tell Avraham, you know, Avraham, there are not 50 righteous men in Sodom. Instead, God plays with Avram and says, okay, Avram, if there are 50 men in Sodom, I'll save it. So does Hashem have to waste Avram's time? Just tell Avram, don't even have five. Right? Instead, Hashem lets it go on. That's the way Hashem talks it. Dibatarka l'shem b'nei Adam. Right? Hashem tells Moshe, if they don't listen to this sign, they'll listen to that sign. Just tell Moshe what they're going to do. No, because they have the free will to do it still. Okay, so Hashem tells Hoshea, you know, you don't even know if these are your kids. But I know what you feel about her. So now you know, don't ever talk that way to me. A prophet has two jobs, to place God's case before the people, Kol Amar Hashem, and to place the people's case before God. Really, Hoshea should have been fired right there. Right? By the rules, he should have been fired. The same way Eliyahu got fired when he spoke against B'nai Yisrael. Hashem tells him in the next pasuk, get Elisha ben Shaphat Navi Techtecha. Right? Okay, so Hoshea gets another chance, and he learns his lesson. Right? If you look at the first Rashi in Perek Bet, right after all this takes place, it's the first pasuk of the Torah, Parshas Bamidbar. Rashi talks about Hoshea learning his lesson and making up for it. Okay, but that's an overall question. There's a bit of interesting scholarship here, is that you see that usually it's the Ashkenazic commentaries, Rashi, Rav Yosef Kara, and Bechor Shor, Zabuzhansi, and guys like that who take the texts literally. Hoshea literally married a harlot because it says so. As opposed to Ibn Ezra, listen to this group, Ibn Ezra, Radak, Rambam, of course, the Mor Nebuchim. These are all the Sfarda commentaries who all say that there's no way he took this woman. It's a dream. It's a vision. Did he marry a woman he knew in the dream? It doesn't matter. It seems she's a famous woman. Okay? The point is that he has to learn his lesson. Can he learn the lesson in a dream? Sometimes. You ever you haven't talked to someone in a long, long time and you have a dream about that person, then you go call? Right? So, okay. Look, Hashem tells Yechezkel, your wife is going to die tomorrow. I want you to, and then God tells him a whole litany of things that are totally antithetical to the current conventions of mourning. To such an extent that if you've ever learned the third parak in Maseches Moed Katan, whatever God tells Yechezkel to do, now this finishes, the opposite is our laws of Avelus. Whole hit litany. We learn that an Avel doesn't wear tefillin the day of the funeral because Hashem tells Yechezkel, your wife is going to die, wear your tefillin. And many other examples like this. So here's the question. Same kind of point. Why is Hashem telling him to do something so bizarre? It's bad enough that his wife dies. He has to actually act out mourning practices. And it says when he acted these things out, the people went to him and said, Yechezkel, your wife just died. Why are you doing these things? And he told them, days will come where you will not be able to mourn your loved ones. Just like I'm not mourning my wife. Mm. It's by a gzeirah from God, a decree from God. And that's why I'm at. Now, so can he get this message across without his wife dying and without it? Well, right? Mm. This has been replicated very, very, very clearly in the Holocaust. Right? How many people who you know, they just turned away. They said, my four siblings were just in line with me. Where are they? I never saw them again. You think they had a chance to sit shiva for them? Right? Mm-hmm. I've said it so many times. My father, at the age of 90, sat shiva for the first time. Mm-hmm. Seven siblings, two parents. Nothing. Right? No yahrzeit. No, yeah. They gave you a seat to sit on and take visitors when right? You're lucky if you survived that day also. Anyway, that's what Yechezkel is talking about. So that's the question I pose to you. Radak, Ibn Ezra, Rambam claim that this message could get across, Yechezkel could get across this message to the people, that if you don't change your ways, not only are you going to have a lot to mourn for, you won't even be able to mourn. Right? That's the question. I don't think that's what's between Rashi and the others. I think Rashi, and this is where the scholarship comes in. A lot of scholars claim that Rashi tended to avoid the allegorical interpretation. Right? She didn't really die. It's a vision. He didn't really take a zona. It's just a vision, because Rashi felt that that's a slippery slope to the Christian approach to not just biblical prophecies in the Nevi'im, Torah mitzvahs in the Torah. Right? Okay, this extends all over the place. It extends to the prediction of Yemot HaMashiach, of the lion living with the lamb, and the wild animals are eating straw with the tame animals. So there, Rashi takes it literally. Those things will happen when Mashiach comes. The Rambam, Radak, Ibn Ezra all say that those are figurative descriptions for nations. The lion and the lamb lying down together is a peace pact between North and South Korea, and you know which is which. Okay? So you too? All right. Okay. What's interesting is that when the Rambam writes this, so the Ravid makes a gloss. You know, the Ravid has these little glosses on the Rambam, saying always very critical of the Rambam. He says, how can you say that it's figurative when it says in the Torah, "V'yishpati chayara min aretz"? This past week's parasha has a pasuk like that. Remember at the end of the parasha, about the animals. So the Ravid says, I disagree with the Rambam. It says in the Torah, "V'yishpati chayara min aretz," which means I will, at least the way the Ravid seems to read it, I will cause to cease the wildness of animals. No more leopards, just sheep. No more lions, just lambs, right? So the Radbaz asks Akasha on the Ravid. He says, why would you ask a question that has such an obvious answer to it? You know what I'm saying? The Rambam takes chapter 11 of Yeshayahu, the lion and the lamb living together, metaphorically. It's allegorical. So the Ravid says, how can you say that if it says in the Torah, Vishpati chayara min aretz? So what's the obvious answer?
That's allegorical too.
That's also allegorical, right. Says the Ravid. What's crazy?
Sinai is allegorical.
So okay, so the Ravid suggests that the Ravid felt that if you want to allegorize in a story about Mashiach, fine, but don't allegorize in the Torah. The next step is a really slippery slope to what the Christians do. You don't have to circumcise the body. That's just a metaphor. You have to circumcise your heart to God. So Christians, let go of circumcision. Next. You don't have to actually eat kosher. You just have to live kosher. Next. You don't have to observe Shabbos. So one by one, everything fell out. So Rashi says, you know what? I'm not going anywhere with this. I'm not allegorizing.
By the way, Rahab is the Christian church in their midrash. Uh-huh. The shani, the hanging of the red ribbon with the stake, the meraglim came into the Christian church.
What?
Okay, it was the rachav. Yeah. So you know, this is you'd be amazed at what symbolizes since you mention it. We're coming up to it. Where Moshe throws down luchos to the ground, right? So, would you agree that Moshe either did so in a fit of anger, or he did so in cold, calculated intention to teach them some kind of message that nothing physical has any inherent holiness? Not the ego you just made, not even these stones that God just gave me. But hardly anybody says that he broke them by accident.
Right.
Except Rashbam.
Who?
Rashbam.
Rashbam?
Rashbam, the Pashtun Uberalis says that he broke them by accident.
Oh my God.
They became heavy.
They became heavy in his hands, and when it says Vayashlichem, he knows that Vayashlichem is a real problem with that. Vayashlichem seems to mean he grabbed them at posts, I grabbed them, and I threw them, purposely. So how does he say he broke them by accident?
Book says that it was very good.
In Mel Brooks or something.
Freud said he couldn't have broken them because if you're betrayed by your disciples so often that you'd have to break them every day. Freud felt he was betrayed, you'd have to break his commandments every day. Well, so you have to learn to hold it in and not break them.
Well, here is, I think, whenever you see something like this in Rashbam, one has to be careful to recognize that Rashbam was one of the great polemicists of the Middle Ages. What I mean is, he inserted into his commentary statements that were meant to be against Christianity. Mm-hmm. But he had to be very careful in doing so, because if you were found to be doing so explicitly,
yes,
it would often be the death of the author, but certainly the destruction of his work. That no shortage of former Jews who combed right through all of our works to make sure that there was no such blatant dishonor to their Lord. So here is what this is, and then we'll come full circle with Rachav, who is this entry into the church. We leave our place and we enter someplace else to her. But here's what it is. Christian theology teaches that the broken covenant has a harbinger in the broken luchos. That Moshe broke the luchos, giving which was an implicit permission to one day break the covenant, which is, I must tell you, such a load of horse feathers, because there are hundreds of psukim, outright psukim in the Tanakh, that indicate Zichru Torah's Moshe Avdi, don't lose the Torah, don't lose sight of the Torah. Someone should let those guys in on this secret, right? Okay, they have their answers. I assure you they have their answers. But it's okay, so what's Rashbam's response to this? And you're not going to persecute him for this. He'll just say that, what do you mean? An intentional harbinger of the broken covenant? He didn't even do it. He did it by accident. You mean the covenant was broken by accident? Right. Even the verses they use about the broken covenant, which is Yirmiyahu chapter 31, right after the Haftorah of Rosh Hashanah, a few psukim after the Haftorah of Rosh Hashanah is over, comes the broken covenant, according to Christianity. What can I say? So okay, let's get back to Rachav. So Yehoshua marrying Rachav is just a fascinating admission on our part that our greatest leaders. There's nothing wrong with marrying. Never mind it. It's not just a Gentile. It's not just a Canaanite of whom the Torah says Lo sechayekon neshama, right? The Gemara in Maseches Sota says that Rachav was already conspiring with them the first time around when the first meraglim came. I call them meraglim now. When the first scouts came in Parsha Shlach, she was well aware of that the day would come where they'd come back, right? Okay, Ramban says something just interesting in Parsha Shlach, that had they gone Taka right into Israel, they all would have accepted that 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 letter. It's just that over 40 years in the desert, became a little brazen. They too, Rahab still says that we heard about all those miracles years back. Mm-hmm. Right? But still, but if it was right after, then things might have been different. Right? So that story in Shlach has a huge effect on our history. Okay? All right, so that's Rahab. Just I'd just like to close the interesting chapter with Yirmiyahu. Rashi insists, the first Rashi in Yirmiyahu insists that Yirmiyahu is a descendant of Rahab, and that he's not of good stock as a result. Right? Now, this is very interesting because, first of all, Yirmiyahu is a Kohen. Right? So, but that's okay. Rahab's descendants could marry someone whose daughter marries a Kohen. There's nothing wrong with that. And then descendants of Kohen. Wouldn't say it's straight down father to son because Yehoshua was not a Kohen either. All right? Look, also, Yirmiyahu comes from a city called Anatot. Do you ever go through this cheshbon with me? Mm-hmm. Anatot is definitely not a city of Miyuchas Dika Kohanim. Right? It's a very complicated proof, but even as Yirmiyahu's father's name is coincidentally the same name as the current Kohen Gadol, right? Chilkiyahu, he's the guy who found the Sefer and the Beis HaMikdash, right? Even though the Targum to the first Pasuk in Yirmiyahu says he was the son of the Kohen Gadol, that's extremely doubtful. Extremely doubtful that someone from Anatot would be the son of the Kohen Gadol. And throughout the book, he never indicates any information, any knowledge about the workings of the Beit HaMikdash, except to state that it's going to be destroyed. The one time at the end of the book where God tells him, go to the Beit HaMikdash, he says, I can't, I'm closed up. Either because he was in jail or he was persona non grata at the Beit HaMikdash. He couldn't go there. He sent Baruch Benaria. As opposed to Yechezkel has inner knowledge of the Beit HaMikdash all throughout his book. He describes things going on in the basement. And he's even living in Bavel when he's writing it. It's all visionary. He even tells you the last 9 chapters how to rebuild the temple. Right? So what is this about Anatot? It's a long story. Aaron had 4 sons. The first 2 died. The last 2, the older of those 2, produced the next few Kohen Gadols. That was Elazar and Pinchas. Right? Somewhere along the line, that Kohen Gadol, that high priesthood, changed from the line of Elazar to Itamar. And the descendant of Itamar, as we see in Divrei Yamim, named Eli, was the Kohen Gadol. Eli's 2 sons, Hophni and coincidentally Pinchas, were very bad, and God predicted to Shmuel during the night that the house of Eli will no longer serve me in perpetuity, they will die young, they will, and they're not going to serve in my temple. So, okay, there was a battle with the Philistines. The sons of Eli took the Aron with them. The Aron was captured. Both boys were killed. And the wife of one of them gave birth and died to a child named
Ichavod.
And that child had a son named Achituv. That man had a son named Achimelech, who had the misfortune of helping David while he was a fugitive of Shaul. Shaul killed all those Kohanim, 85 families, only one child named Eviatar escaped and joined David. Right? And David said, whoever wants to kill you wants to kill me. That should make us friends, right? So Eviatar joined David, was a loyal servant, and became the Kohen Gadol when David became king. But Eviatar made a bad decision later in life. When David's son Adoniyahu crowned himself king, rather than wait for David to crown the king, right? So we all know how the story went. It's that Torah Parshas Chayesara. In the end, Shlomo became king. When Shlomo became king, he called over Eviatar and he said, "Listen, you made a bad decision. You sided with the wrong guy. I'm not going to kill you. You were a very loyal servant of my father, but I'm going to banish you." And he says, "Go to Anatot outside of Yerushalayim and live there for the rest of your life. You're not serving in my temple." And then it says, a little note by the author, it says, this was to fulfill the promise made about the sons of Eli. Right? So if you live in Anatot, you're not the son of the Kohen Gadol. Right? You are the descendant of Rahab. Okay? Right. Okay, so
after the children of Eli died, then what was the line for the Kohen Gadol after that?
It went back to Elazar's side. Okay. All right, so I guess that's all we're going to say about Rochav and Yehoshua. Okay. So now I'd like to do a very unconventional, maybe I'll save that till next week. But let's say a few words about Devorah and Barak. Devorah and Barak. Chazal say that they were actually married, even though it's very strange because she's called Eshet Lapidot, right? So Mistama, she had a husband named Lapidot. How many husbands does she have?
Could this be like Hashvag Leiri, woman maybe? Like Lapidot,
Lapidot? Yeah, it's Rashi says. She's twisted Lapidot for the Mishkan, right? All right, so it could be a description of her. She was a woman on fire, right?
Fire, yeah.
Or Lapidot Barak is almost like the same word.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. So we have a little bit of a dialogue between them. So let's take a look. Let's open up to Shoftim Perek Daled. You know, the Bible is not very very rich on dialogue between spouses. Perek Daled Pasuk Daled. Perek Daled Pasuk Daled Shoftim 590. 590. Udevora Ishon Nevia Eshet Lapidot. He Shoftot Yisrael Ba'etahi. Very interesting that whenever we have a Nevia in Tanakh, it tells us her husband's name, except Miriam. The Torah does not ever tell us, even if Miriam was married, except for the hint when she seems to say she's married, when she talks about Moshe's, does God only talk to him and he doesn't pay attention to his wife? God talks to us too, and we maintain our marital connections. All right, based on Psukim and Divrei Hayamim, the rabbis maintain that she was married to Kalev. Mm-hmm. Wow. Why do I say wow? Because Kalev is a good 50 years younger than she is. But okay, fair enough. It's nice once in a while a woman gets a younger man.
But who is this? Miriam?
Hur is their son.
Miriam is married to Kalev Ben Yefuneh.
To who? Miriam is married to who?
Kalev Ben Yefuneh.
Oh,
there has to be something a bit deeper there.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, but Chazal do indicate that she is married. Mm-hmm. Right? The point I'm making is that in the ancient world, priestesses, when not, you know, they weren't really in the married set. They either belonged to everyone in town or to no one in town, if you know what I mean. We'll get into the intricate details. But in our Tanakh, it's true about men, but it's maybe even more true about women. You're not holy if you're. In other words, you reach your peak of holiness, unlike in the ancient pagans, where your holiness is hindered by marriage, right? Like in some systems today, right? Right. So comes our Tanakh to tell us that, especially the women, right? Why should I care to know what the name of Chulda's husband was? For goodness sakes. Who cares? It doesn't say anything about him. It just mentions his name.
She has
been. Right? Right?
We know she's married.
That's the point. Okay. V'hi yoshevet tachat tomer devora. You ever learn that sefer?
Yeah.
It's a nice Kabbalistic work. All right. She would sit under the tomer that was named, the tamarisk, some translate, that was named for her. Bein harama uvein beitel b'har Ephraim. Right? Not far from where Shmuel would live. V'yelu eleh b'nei Yisrael l'mishpat. And everybody went up to, if you know where this is, it's really an aliyah from all over the place. A huge valley right there, and then right near is Ramot. Right? So it's high places. Okay, so that's why it says v'yelu eleh. Plus, the courts tended to be in a place where you had to, you had to go up some to reach these places. Patishlach vatikra le Barak ben Avinoam mi Kedesh Naphtali. Now that's the distance, mm-hmm. right? She is near near remote, I guess. Near
it says Ramah.
Right? What?
It says Ramah.
Yeah, Ramah is Ramatayim Sofim.
It says
Beit El
is a little further north.
Yeah. Fame between, yeah. This Binyamin is near there also. This is Ephraim.
Yes, this is.
Yeah. Okay, so she sent for Barak ben Avinoam from Kedesh Naphtali, that's up in the north. Vatomer Elav, Halot Tziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Lech Umashachta Behar Tavor, Velakachta Imcha Aseret Alafim Ish Mibnei Naphtali, Mibnei Zvulun. I want you to take 10,000 men from these two tribes. Okay, we're going to see that the one of the great ills of Sefer Shoftim manifests itself here, is that when one tribe is threatened by an enemy, the Plishtim, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the other tribes don't care to join in. What do you mean? What should I bother? I come from Haifa. The missiles from Gaza aren't reaching Haifa, so I'm not taking part. Right? Okay. I'm saying so. In other words, this goes down throughout, goes on really throughout the book. Right? Umashachti alecha el nachal kishon et sisra sartzva yavin ve'esrichbo ve'samono unesatzi ubiadecha. And she's telling him this. You know, let's say in other stories in Shoftim, it's an angel that tells Gideon. Mm-hmm. And even there, he doubts whether he's actually getting a message from God. Remember, he keeps asking for signs. So here, it's a woman. She's a human being, right? This is his wife, according to the Gemara, right? So she's telling him to do these things, and you will defeat Sisera in this place. Right? Even though Sisera has 900, not 600, 900 chariots. Right? The Jews didn't even have one. All right, but if you know the topography, you could just draw those chariots into jagged, rocky areas and neutralize all of them.
Into the Kishon.
Nachal Kishon, of course.
Muddy. When it becomes a harsh wadi.
Yeah. And muddy. And okay. It says even the stars were fighting against them in the Shira. Okay, so what does he tell her? Remember Eleha Barak. Im telchi imi, v'halachti. Im lo telchi imi, lo elech. So, you know, she was such a powerful force. I can't do this myself. If you go, what is it? Why? Because you'll be a better strategist? You'll be a better... if you're there, I feel that you're bringing God's presence with you, and we will defeat them. So what did she say? Batomer, Halochei lechimach, I will go with you. Efes, ki lo tihiya tifartecha al haderech asher ata olech, ki biyad isha yimkor Hashem et Sisera. Right? The glory shall not come to you. The hero of this day shall be a woman. Now, when you're reading this the first time, you feel she means herself.
Right.
I'll go with you. I'm going to get all the glory.
Right?
Yeah, of course. Vatakam devorah vatelech in Barak kedsha. Right, so she went with Barak, and of course, what happened is that he tries to get other tribes to come and join, and no one's at home, right? And like Hashem promised, very quickly the war is dispatched very quickly. It's just the bulk of the discussion is about how Yael lured him into her tent. And she killed him with a tent peg. Just I'll close this with a little bit of scholarship. There's a story in the Apocrypha known as Judith. You familiar with it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yehudis. Yes. We eat milk foods on Hanukkah because of her. I've seen menorahs with a. There's a woman on every candle with a sword in one hand in the air and a head in the other hand. So this scholar in Los Angeles named David Beale, Biale, he says that the reason why Judith wasn't canonized in the Tanakh is because, and it's a nice story, it's a heroic story. The reason why Judith is not canonized in the Tanakh is because she killed the villain with a sword. A sword is not shayach, it's begadish, it's a clay gever, it's a man's occupation, it's a man's thing. So she should have killed him the way Yael did. What did Yael use?
With a peg and a hammer.
That's a woman's thing. That's what women mean. So had she killed her like Yael, she would have been canonized also in the Bible. This is worse than horse feathers. So you see, first of all, Judith isn't canonized for a host of other reasons. I won't get into them now. If you read Schneur Lyman's book on canonization, you can read 10 of them. But as far as why Yael uses a tent peg to dispatch Sisera, it's very simple. She could have used a sword too. In fact, Radak asked, why didn't you just get a sword and stab him and kill him? Because, listen, he's a trained soldier. Yes, he's very tired. She gave him milk. She got him sleepy. But if she tiptoes in to kill him, right? And then he wakes up in a second. He's a trained soldier. He's going to wake up on any stirring. And right. He sees her with a knife in her hand, he'll kill her.
Right.
What are you doing here? But if he sees her with a hammer in one hand and a tent peg in the other, and he says, and he wakes up and goes, what are you doing here? Shh, go back to sleep. Go back. You told me that you don't want anyone to know you're here. The end of the end of the tent started to pick up in the wind. I wanna nail it down. Right? If he does, you know, find and discover what she's doing, you know, with the tent peg in her hand, she has a shtickle excuse. Okay? All right, Heber, that'll do it for us today. Shimshon and Delilah next week.